This is Moravian Mornings, a podcast discussing the history surrounding the Moravians who settled in Wachovia.
Good morning, everyone. I know it might not be morning for you, but it definitely is for us. But if it's evening or afternoon, or even if it's nighttime, I hope your day is going well or was well. Last week, Maisie and I discussed some Moravian customs and traditions. This week, we thought it would be beneficial to actually speak with some of the staff at Historic Bathabra Park. Diana is the education director, and she has been with the park for 13 years. During the recording of this interview, Samantha was the director of Historic Bathabra Park, but she is now currently the director of community engagement and digital learning at Old Salem. Diana and Samantha, would you both explain your duties at the park?
Sure. So I'm Diana, and I'm in charge of the educational programming at the park, which means that I create and plan things like school tours and summer programs, as well as training and educating our guide staff who give tours of the site. I also handle a lot of the day-to-day operations of the park, like making sure the visitor center is staffed and also scheduling guided tours for both kids and adults.
And I'm Samantha Smith. I'm the executive director of Historic Bathabra Park. My job basically entails everything that Diana doesn't do. My job is basically everything that doesn't fall into those categories. So that could be anything from collaborating with local colleges and universities, with historians and archaeologists to do projects. I also direct the community garden here. I work with the maintenance team to make sure everything is always looking good in the park and that the buildings are well kept. And I also help develop some of the special events we do and different educational programming that is not for school-age children.
Why don't you tell our listeners why you think it's important to discuss the Moravian history surrounding the area?
That's a really great question. I think especially if you're from Winston-Salem or even the Piedmont of North Carolina, understanding that early Moravian story is really the early American story in this region. And there's just so much that happened at Bathabra, Bethania, Salem, all of the what they call the Moravian towns, that I think it sheds a lot of light on major events that happened here in early America and in the early Republic. Especially people, if they're interested in the French and Indian War or the American Revolution, because the Moravians were such great record keepers, they have a very interesting perspective and pretty thorough records of some of these events that you typically wouldn't get that perspective from.
Yeah, and not only that, you know, the Moravians were neutral. They were pacifists in the 18th century. So that means, like, when they're talking about the American Revolution or the Regulator Movement or the French and Indian War, they're not really taking sides. So that means that they have both sides coming through their towns and taking supplies and things, but they're interacting with both sides conflict in all of those particular situations too.
That's exactly right. It's as close to a unbiased argument, that doesn't exist, an unbiased historical record, but at least it's a different perspective of a group that's not participating actively and openly in either side, which is pretty rare in the historical record. And I also just want to say that the Moravians by themselves, even if we're not thinking about these larger events, But their story in and of themselves is just fascinating, especially the wonderful craftsmen and artisans that came from Bathabra, Salem. North Carolina pottery tradition, which is such a huge deal in North Carolina, that cultural, traditional, artisanal craft, it really originated in a large way at Bathabra, as did brewing and distilling, which have become so important in North Carolina culture of today. So looking at Bathabra and Salem and Bethania, these early settlements, it's a great way to kind of go back in time and then trace how we got here today with these important cultural traditions from our state.
Pottery is definitely one of the more well-known trades of the Moravians. Another thing that really stands out to everyone that knows about the Moravians is their choir system and how they lived in these groups that were essentially their spiritual family. Each group had a choir helper that was over the leadership of that choir. Being a choir helper seems to be a large responsibility within the church. How are choir helpers chosen?
Well, I can answer that because I just looked into the instructions for the Moravian Choir Helpers. There's actually a really great book by Catherine Fall that's called Speaking to Body and Soul that actually has all of those instructions translated into English. And they're really interesting, but according to this book, and this is coming from the actual instructions themselves that were given in 1785 and 1786, like single sisters were chosen, quote, who possessed gifts and grace and who were known to their peers so that their peers felt confident in confiding in them. There's an interesting bit of information in the instructions for the married people's choirs. Apparently, like a husband and a wife were chosen to be the choir helper of the married women's choir and the choir helper of the married men's choir. And it talks about how the woman, the female married choir helper, quote, takes it upon herself to give advice in serious situations without the knowledge of her husband, or even conceals things that concern not only a married sister, but also her husband, and hides this from her husband. If she did something like that, basically she would lose her role as choir helper and her husband would be fired at the same time. So nope. It's kind of funny because I think you basically needed two things to be a great choir helper, according to the church. You had to be someone that other people trusted enough to confide in, but you also had to be a person who would be willing to tell church authorities if what the person told you raised alarm of, like, any kind.
But I'm going to tell the church everything you say.
Yeah, pretty much. Like, you can tell me, but then I'm also going to tell other people.
So, in addition to the choir system, in our last episode, we also talked about the law and some of the uses that the Moravian Church used it for. Are there any particular uses of the law that stand out to you?
I definitely have one. I think probably the most significant use of the law is when the church elders had to consult it to determine whether or not they should purchase Johann Samuel, who was an enslaved man that the Moravians were renting in town. And according to the records, which of course are coming from the Moravians themselves, it says he expressed a desire to know the Savior and he wished to be purchased by the church so he could stay. That's, of course, according to the diaries written by the Moravians. But the church listened to his request and they consulted the lot and the yes slip was drawn. And it just fascinates me that it happened in that way, because what if the no slip was drawn? I mean, it seems like that one act and one decision completely changed the course of history. So I think, especially in that case, that's probably the most significant and impactful use of the law to me. What about you, Diana?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And that's something I've thought about a lot. Like, I've always wondered if, you know, they had drawn that no instead of the yes, if it would have prevented slavery from occurring in the Moravian towns, or if it would have just delayed it. Like, I wonder if as time went on and American ideologies or Southern American ideologies encroached further and further into the towns, if they would have been like, let's ask the lot again about this. So that's one thing I have wondered about related to that particular question. Another one that just kind of blows my mind when I think about it a lot is that the lot for many, many years determined who you married. So basically the lot was determining who married who and who had children. And, you know, so basically the lot has played a major role in the genetics of descendants of Moravians from the 18th century. And it's just kind of weird to think about, because, you know, if a man went and proposed to a certain single sister and then the lot said no, then he picked a different woman. And if he picked the first woman, then the genetic line would have been completely different, which to me is just kind of mind-blowing.
Going off when Diana mentioned the lot being asked in the cases of marriage, there was a process for a single brother to go through in order to be seen as ready to marry in the Moravian society, with this process essentially ending with the lot being asked. Are there any instances of the lot not being used in the case of a marriage proposal? Maybe the single brother received a no answer from the lot and the couple decided to marry anyway, just completely ignoring the lot? And if there are any cases, what happened to the couple?
I have one from Salem, Diana. I don't know if I have one from Pythabora. Do you have a Pythabora example?
I have the Salem example because it happens so very, very rarely that my example is also from Salem.
Is it Dr. Vierling?
No, it's not. Oh, okay. Do you want me to go first, Samantha?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. All right. So there's one really interesting story out of Salem from 1803 where a single brother proposed to a single sister in secret, asking her to wait and marry him when he was able to support her. And she said yes. And this was like going against all the rules because the single brother was supposed to go to his choir helper and say that he was ready to get married. And he and the choir helper were going to have this discussion about, okay, are you ready to get married? Yeah, you are. Okay. And then the choir helper would go and consult with the single sister's choir helper and they would find a good match. And then they would take it to the lot. So basically he like skipped all of those steps and just went straight to the woman he was interested in and asked her. It came to light because a different single brother wanted to marry this single sister and she had to admit that she was already betrothed to someone else.
Oh, this is juicy.
Basically, they were told by church elders that they had to break off their proposal and show an appropriate amount of remorse for breaking the rules. And if they did that, they could stay part of the Moravian congregation. However, one of them was going to be moved to a different congregation, probably up in Pennsylvania, because we didn't want to have any fair chance of them seeing each other again.
It sounds essentially like a timeout.
Yeah, it does. It does. And basically, like, the couple were like, no, we're not doing that. And ooh. So the church said, okay, we won't stand in the way of you getting married, but pack up your things because you're leaving the congregation now. You're no longer part of the Moravian Church. So they left. They left Salem, and I assume they went off on their own and got married and continued living their lives. I do not know the names of either of these people because they're just listed in initials in the records.
I knew there had to be like a Moravian version of Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, exactly.
That is definitely a Moravian Romeo and Juliet. That's such a cool story. Mine is also from Salem, and I'm not sure if this is exactly what plays into this. Mine kind of is related, but not quite. And there might be more examples of this, but I do know that in Salem, Dr. Vierling, he was an eligible bachelor. The church went to him and they said, hey, it's time for you to get married. There was another very eligible bachelorette, Martha Mitch, in town. And the church came to him and said, you know, we think Martha Mitch might be a good match for you. What do you think? And Dr. Vierling said, no, not interested. So the church was like, okay. And the church did listen to him saying that he wasn't interested in her. And so he presented another woman that he was interested in to the church. And when they drew the lot, yes was drawn. And so he married that woman. And a few years went by, and sadly, that woman actually died. And so he was eligible to be married again. And the second time around, he ended up marrying Martha Mitch. So the lot was used, but I just thought it was a good example of how the lot didn't always mean that the church got to say, you and this person, yes or no? Yes. Okay, you're married. You did still have a little bit of a say in the decision of who you would be potentially marrying. And Diana, that was the same in Pythabora, right?
Yeah, it would have been the same in Pythabora. Casey, to answer your other question, if the couple wanted to get married and the no slip was drawn, they could still get married. But just like what happened in that other example, they had to leave the church in order to get married. And the church was okay with that. They kind of parted on amiable terms. But it was just like, according to the Lord's will, you guys aren't supposed to get married. So we can't endorse that. But, you know, if you want to leave our community and do that, you can. That's basically the way that usually worked. It was very rare, though, that any of those examples really happened, because basically the way that Moravians thought was, okay, I'm going to do what the church asks of me. And if they are asking me if I want to marry this single brother, you know, I'm going to think about this, and I can say no, but, you know, it seems like this might be the best thing for me to do. So yes, I'll marry this person, you know, so it didn't happen all that frequently, but they do make really interesting stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was really interesting, Diana.
That is insane that they would kick these couples out of the church and send one of them to a different congregation.
If they had shown remorse and also did not get married, they could stay in the church, but they were also going to be completely separated. Or they could get married, but if they got married, they had to leave the church. And those were like the two options they were given.
As we discussed a little bit in episode one, a lot of these weddings were celebrated with a love feast. And we sort of went into detail about some instances in which that love feast would be held. Could you all describe a little bit about the modern love feasts that take place at Bethabara?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So something that's really important to historic Bethabara Park is the connection that we have to the modern congregation at Bethabara Moravian Church, who can, you know, they trace their connection all the way back to the original congregation that settled Bethabara, which is really special. And they worshiped in the original Gemeinhaus Church for years. They actually didn't leave it until, was it 1953, Diana?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Pretty much from 1788 to 1953, the Bethabara Moravian Church congregation worshiped there, and now they're just down the road. So we think it's important that we still partner with them and connect with them, since they're a major stakeholder in this history. And Christmas is a good time to do that, because the Moravians really went hard for Christmas. They had what were called love feasts, which were kind of it varied through time. It changed. And when I say they went hard, it doesn't necessarily mean that they've decked out in Christmas decorations. That's not what I mean. It's more like it was a very special time of community bonding and sharing and love. And the love feast that we do today, we basically welcome back the congregation to come into the original Gemeinhaus to do a traditional love feast where people share the buns and the coffee, and there's a sermon and singing, lots of singing. And we try to make it as traditional as possible so that it can be kind of a reminder of the types of love feasts that would have happened in the Gemeinhaus over time. And even from the beginning, the love feast was comprised of sharing a simple meal together, praying together, singing together. And so the traditional pillars of what a love feast is has really survived all this time. It's gotten probably changed over time a bit, but being able to experience a love feast like that in that space is really meaningful and impactful. And I think it's a really significant event for the park and for the congregation to be able to kind of share that history together in that space. Because yes, it is a religious service, but I'd say most of the people who go to the event and attend it do so they can also experience the historical aspect of being in that historical sacred space and experiencing an event that would have taken place there 200 years before. So it's a really cool event.
We know that the Moravians really had a different perspective on women's roles in their communities. Based on norms at the time that Bethabara was established, many women were denied the chance to receive a formal education. Why did the Moravians choose to educate their women?
That's a good question, because most women during that time period were not usually getting an education, or not much of one anyway, especially not things like reading and writing, which is what the Moravians were teaching young girls that were growing up in the Moravian church. Basically, the Moravians believed everyone was spiritually equal before the eyes of God. And in order to get to know God, you needed to be able to read the scripture. So that's why both girls and boys learned how to read and write. Education was always extremely important to the Moravians. And they also taught both boys and girls music, which was another important aspect of Moravian life and church services. So they were usually taught how to read music, how to play some instruments and that kind of thing as well. So basically it was like, there was a spiritual reason for it. It was a way to be able to participate more in their services, both musically and also by getting to know the scripture.
Yeah, exactly. I would also add, it was important for women to be educated almost also because the Moravians were so separatist by having men kind of worship together, women kind of worship together. So I think it was important for them to be able to have women leaders within the church. Diana, would you say? And I think that also plays into needing to educate women so that they could lead that separate sect of women in the Moravian community because they wish to be more separate in their services.
Definitely.
So just going off of that, could you talk a little bit more about positions that women were able to hold in Moravian society that maybe weren't seen as acceptable for women to hold outside of Moravian communities?
I think they were mostly within the church. I think the highest level position a woman could achieve was a deaconess. Is that right, Diana?
Yeah, it was up until, at one point they were allowed to become priestesses, but after Zinzendorf, Count Zinzendorf, who was a major contributor to the Moravian ideology and everything, he believed that women could become priestesses, but after he died, there was kind of some changes that were made, and one of them was that women couldn't be priestesses anymore. I think women could still be deaconesses, though, but I think they had to be married. Did they have to be married to a man who was a minister in order to be a deaconess, Samantha?
That sounds right. I think later on that was the case. And I know the deaconess that we talked about at Bethabara, I'm blanking on her name, but I'm pretty sure she was married to a deacon.
Oh, yeah. Christina Heinrich.
Christina Heinrich.
Yeah, she and her husband were part of the first group of married couples that came down. And they were also, in addition to being like the minister and the minister's wife, and they were like the choir helpers too. Like he dealt with the married men and she dealt with the married women as well.
Right.
I recently did a lot of research about Anna Johanna Kraus. She was the first child born in Bethabara. She became an acolyte. She never married. She was always a single sister. She rose up into the single sisters choir. She became an acolyte, which was a person who helped administer the Holy Communion. And she also became a member of the Helper Conference, which was one of the governing boards that made decisions about what happened to residents of Wachovia, Bethabara, Bethania, Salem, all the towns in Wachovia. And she never married, but was able to take on those larger roles within the church because of, you know, I think she was just sort of a model Moravian. She wasn't going around accepting secret proposals from men.
So just to sort of, I guess, round out this interview, we wanted to know what are some of the most interesting Moravian stories from Bethabara that you've learned during your time working here?
I've got one that's definitely my favorite, probably because I really appreciate the power of material culture along with stories. But I think my favorite story here is related to when the congregation moved from the old Gemeinhaus to the new Gemeinhaus, because there's a really detailed, wonderful diary entry for that event. And one of the really cool details of it is that the minister, when they decided to start the procession from the old to the new, he took the lantern down from the old Gemeinhaus. And while it was still lit, he walked to the new one with the whole congregation kind of trailing behind him, following him into the new church. And when he arrived into the new Gemeinhaus, he hung the lantern on the wall. And I like to tell myself that it's been hanging there just like that ever since. And it's just a really nice kind of romantic story that goes behind an object that you probably wouldn't even really notice if you go in the Gemeinhaus. It's not the first artifact that really hits you in the face. There are a lot of other things in there that would really grab your attention, but I think just knowing the story behind it gives it so much meaning. And every time I walk in the Gemeinhaus and see it, I get a little chill.
I don't know. I mean, I have a lot of them. I've learned so much since I've started working at Bethabara. I knew a lot about Salem before, but not as much about Bethabara, and just learning about how much adversity they faced when they were first here. Within just a few years of getting here, they faced the French and Indian War. They faced the typhus outbreak that killed 10 people. there was a lot of hardship, but there was also so much joy and celebration that you always see in the records that just makes me think, you know, that they were able to get through so much because of their faith. One of the stories that I really love is in 1755, the first married people came down to North Carolina from Bethlehem, and the single brothers who had been alone in Bethabara since 1753 awaited their arrival. And when they heard them coming, the married people started playing musical instruments, and the single brothers like climbed up to the top of the single brothers' house, the brand new single brothers' house that had just been built, three stories tall. They were up on the roof playing trumpets and trombones and things, welcoming the married couples as they came into sight. And then they all saw each other and they just were overjoyed and hugging and welcoming each other and sharing news from Bethlehem and the family members and stuff that were back home. And, you know, there's so much hardship that you can find in the records, but there's so much joy in there as well.
Their community sounds so warm and welcoming.
I think there was a reason why there were so many people that were attracted to the Moravian faith. I mean, I think it provides a community and a warmth and a spiritual family as well.
John Wesley was so inspired by the Moravians and their faith when he was aboard that ship that was very likely going to sink. And the Moravians were on board singing, and they were joyous and happy, and they were like, "We're gonna die and meet God." And he was like, "What are these guys doing, Dan Bickel? That's faith." And so it really, the Moravians inspired him to kind of create Methodism as we know it. So that's another just kind of interesting facet of the Moravian faith.
Yeah.
I guess that would make me feel better if I was going down on a ship and everyone around me is like, "We're gonna have a party and meet God, and it is gonna be great, so don't panic.
We're going down swinging."
Oh my gosh.
Thank you both so much for joining us for our first interview of the series. It was so great to speak with both of you and learn more about the Moravians.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it was so much fun, guys. I think those last two stories are the perfect way to round out this first interview. Yeah. They're very uplifting and happy.
This has been an episode of Moravian Mornings, a historic Bethabara Park podcast. If you have any questions or would like our hosts to discuss certain topics, please email us at moravianmornings@gmail.com or message us on our Instagram page, also titled Moravian Mornings. Thanks for listening. Auf Wiedersehen.